Good evening, everyone. Welcome to another Clear Mountain Wednesday. Tonight, we are very happy to have Bill Porter, aka Red Pine, with us. Bill, thank you so much for joining us.
You're welcome.
So I'll just read a quick biography. So Bill Porter assumes the pen name Red Pine for his translation work. He was born in Los Angeles in 1943, grew up in the Idaho Panhandle, served a tour of duty in the U.S. Army, graduated from University of California with a degree in anthropology, and attended graduate school at Columbia University. Uninspired by the prospect of stations in Taiwan and Hong Kong, where he interviewed local dignitaries and produced more than 1,000 programs about his travels in China. His translated poetry collections include The Collected Songs of Cold Mountain and The Mountain Poems of Stonehouse. His sutra translations include The Diamond Sutra, Heart Sutra, Platform Sutra, and Lankavatara Sutra. And his personal writings include Zen Baggage, A Pilgrimage to China, and Road to Heaven, Encounters with Chinese Hermits, which inspired the director Ted Berger to seek out and study with Buddhist hermits in the Zhongnan Mountains of China and to direct the 2005 film Amongst White Clouds. Red Pine's translations have been widely acclaimed, earning him awards such as the Thornton Wilder Prize for translation. He has lived in East Asia for many years and now resides in Port Townsend, Washington.
So, Bill, we were hoping that you might begin just by reciting or singing one of your translations of Cold Mountain's poems. He's one of, you know, your favorite poets, and we would love to hear his words, his words in your voice.
离他情皎洁无堪理论叫我如何说 My mind is like the autumn moon, clear and bright in a pool of jade. Nothing can compare. What more can I say? A man of a few words, Cold Mountain, but powerful.
Bill, something you had said in one of your books is that every time you translate a book of poems, it's like you learn a new way of dancing, and that the music has to be Chinese. Could you talk a little bit about your connection with China and the Chinese language?
What do you mean connection? I mean, how far back are we going?
Yeah, how far back does it go? I mean, I don't know if you believe in past lives, but how far back does it go this life?
Well, I have no idea about the last life, but something must have been at work because I was graduating from UC Santa Barbara and I with a degree in anthropology, and I didn't really want to go out and try to get a job, so I thought I'd go to graduate school. This was 1970. The best department, I thought, in America was Columbia, and I thought I'd go studied with their faculty there. It included Margaret Mead, Ruth Benedict, just a tremendous faculty. So I applied, and the only money I had was the $175 I got every month from the GI Bill. So my father had gone bankrupt, so he didn't have any means to help me. And I was just checking all the boxes. And, what's this? A language fellowship. Funded by the Defense Department. You had to be an American citizen, and it had to be a language few Americans study, a rare language, as they called it. And I just read a book by Alan Watts called The Way of Zen. It had these funny Chinese characters in it. I mean, I like what Alan Watts had to say about Zen, but I was more impressed by that people could read those characters. And on a whim, I just wrote in the word Chinese. I had no interest in Chinese or China. I was interested in studying anthropology theory. That's a long story in itself, but basically that was why I checked that box, just on a whim. And they gave me a four-year fellowship. It was truly an embarrassment. Because I was a fraud. I had no interest in this at all, but I went naturally because I wanted the money to go to grad school. But it was a terrible and a terrifying experience. To get the fellowship required I take intensive Chinese, which was 3 hours a day, 5 days a week. And the professor was notorious, to say the least. Her name, everybody called her the Dragon Lady, and she was the Dragon Lady. We started with 24 students. By the end of the third week, there were only four of us left. And she asked me to stay after and said, "Mr. Porter, I only teach the best and you're not good enough. I want you to drop the class." I told her, I can't drop it. My fellowship requires I take this class. She said, "I don't care. As far as I'm concerned, you don't exist anymore." And so I continued to come to class and I didn't exist. And after about 2 weeks of this, I went to the department chairman, Hans Bielenstein, and told him about this, and he made her include me in the class. She got even by giving me a D for the class, which canceled my fellowship. So I had to take a special proctored exam to prove that I had acquired the skills necessary, that in short, you can do this sometimes at universities. You can challenge a class for credit. So that's basically what I did. I challenged the class that I had just flunked for credit, and I got a B in that exam. So I continued on, but it was a terrifying experience and hard because I had no affinity for Chinese. Very hard. Memorize all those characters and those lines in the characters, too. Anyway, that was my introduction. But I stuck with it. But during that first year, I met a monk in Chinatown, a Chinese monk. I didn't know how famous he was, but he was very famous in China. He lived on Wu Tai Shan for many years. His name was Shou Ye. Shou is long life, and Ye it means to cure. And he taught me how to meditate, and I started spending weekends with him. He had a little retreat center up outside of New York. And by the end of the second year, I realized that I was very impressed with him as a person. We could hardly communicate. He spoke no English other than the word. The only English word he knew that I know that he knew was watermelon. And my Chinese was rudimentary because, you know, I was, yeah, anyway, wasn't good at it. So I didn't really know much about what he was saying, but I was impressed with him, who he was, and how he acted, his presentation. And again, he taught me how to meditate, and he I really liked that. And I thought this is a much more interesting path than getting a PhD, becoming a professor, and creating more professors or failed professors. So at the end of the second year, I gave them back the remaining 2 years of the fellowship. And then went to Taiwan to live in at a Buddhist monastery that one of the fellow classmates who had not survived the Dragon Lady, Gerhard Herzog, had been to Taiwan, had been to this monastery. He gave me their address. I wrote them. They said, "Come on over." So I moved to this monastery in Taiwan. I had no idea about sects, you know, not S-E-X, but S-E-T-T-S. Of Buddhism. I thought everything was Zen. What the hell? here, and of course, Fo Guang Shan turned out to be a Pure Land temple, you know, and I was, you know, so thankful for being there. I took part in all the prostrations and the chanting and what the focus of Pure Land practice. They do very little seated meditation, if any at all, or did at least at Fo Guang Shan. So after anyway, I did spent a year there, and a Chinese friend encouraged me to go study at a Chinese Taiwan university to improve my Chinese, and I did that for a few months, and then decided I need to go to another monastery. So I went to a Zen monastery. The abbot was the head of the Rinzai sect, the Linji sect in China, and he'd come to Taiwan. So I stayed with him about 2.5 years. And started studying Chinese classical Chinese, because I could go to Taipei. His monastery was only about a 45-minute train ride to Taipei, and I could get English translations of things, and I would get Chinese texts and then get an English translation and start learning the classical language. Well, that's how it sort of began. That's the connection.
Eventually, that path led you to see if these hermits you'd begun to translate and read, Cold Mountain, Stonehouse, still people like them still existed, and drew you back to the hermit mountains in China. Would you talk about that return and who you met? What were the hermits that you met there? What were they like? What were how'd you, you tell us about that trip?
Well, just before I left the Zen monastery, Haiming Si, the abbot gave me a book that he had helped finance. It was the poetry of Cold Mountain. And somehow he had gotten involved in it and said, "Here, I got a bunch of these copies. Why don't you take one?" So I did. I couldn't believe that somebody put Cold Mountain's poems in my hand. So when I left the monastery, I started translating Cold Mountain and lived in this farm. I ended up living in this farming village for the next 14 years on a mountain called Qixing Shan, Seven Star Mountain. It was above Yangmingshan outside of Taipei. It used to snow every year. It was up the higher elevations. Just farmers, that's the only people who lived there. But there were some farm sheds that farmers had, one farmer had converted, and he rented a couple of them out. So I started translating Cold Mountain, and that was getting nowhere. A friend of mine, I was helping him translate a martial arts text from the Qing Dynasty, and he said, "Hey, you've got all these books by John Blofeld. Why don't you ask him?" I didn't know you could write an author. So I thought it was rather bold. I wrote a letter to care of his publisher, and about a month later, I got a letter from John. He was living in Thailand, and he said, "Send me some of these poems." So I sent him 10 translations. A couple of weeks later, I got my originals covered with his notes, and he said, "Send me 10 more." And this went on for a year and a half, and I ended up translating the whole thing, all 300 poems. And I was really excited that I'd actually accomplished that. I had no idea I could do that. That was not my intent. But I loved the poems. And I sent them off to publishers in America thinking, "Wow, I have a book here, don't sort of." So I sent them to Tuttle, Weatherhill, Shambhala. I still have the letter of rejection from Sam Burke at Shambhala. And I mean to make a copy and send it to him one of these days. It's a treasure. It was a very beautiful letter. No, there's just no market, Bill. Shortly after that, an American friend, American person who had heard about me, knocked on my door. He found his way up to this mountain and knocked on my door and said, "I heard you're working on Cold Mountain. Do you need a publisher?" I said, "Duh. What do you?" And so he introduced me to this publisher here in Port Townsend, Copper Canyon Press. The publisher was a big fan of the Beat Generation. He knew most of the people involved in that, and he published my first book of Cold Mountain. But in the process of working on Cold Mountain's poems, I got some other editions, a Qing Dynasty edition that included the poems of other poets. And the poem after Cold Mountain was this other a monk named Stonehouse. And I said, "Wow, I can't believe this. This guy is better than Cold Mountain." I mean, which is hard to say, but it's true. He write he wrote a better poem.
What was so good about those two poets, just quickly to stop there, what made them unique?
Well, they were both Dharma poets. They were two of the greatest poets in China who put the Dharma into words and wrote poems, because the greatest literary form to the Chinese is poetry, just as the greatest art form is calligraphy, not landscape paintings, for God forbid.
No.
Things that show your heart. Poetry and calligraphy show your heart. And to write something in language that shows your heart, and which in these case was the Dharma heart, was extraordinary. Anyway, I couldn't help myself. I translated Stonehouse too, and eventually I wondered if people like this really existed, or is this some kind of literary conceit? So I went to China to find these people like that.
We definitely want to ask more about actual encountering of present day hermits or when you first went. But could I just read a quick poem by Stonehouse, one of the ones which I really appreciated.
You want to read it? Or want me to?
I've got one that I picked out.
Oh, good. Why don't you read it?
Okay. So a white-haired Zen monk with a hut for my home. The wind has torn my robe into rags. Down by the stream, I rake leaves for my stove. After a frost, I wrap a mat around my orange tree. Ultimate reality isn't created. Ready-made koans aren't worth a thought. All day I sit by my open window, looking at mountains without lowering the shade. Bill, you've said that translating or reading someone's poem, you get to know the kind of person who they are. What did you learn about Stonehouse? What kind of person was he?
He reminded me of this man who was sort of the first, I'd call him a real human being that I met when I was growing up. My father had hired him to arrange our hunting and fishing trips. A man named George Williams taught me how to hunt, fish, play cribbage. Although he was a very special man because when he was doing this, my mother told me that, because I asked, why are we always going on private land to hunt and fish? Why don't we go into the national, in the state parks or whatever, another land? She said, well, we can't go into public land because if we ever do, and we meet a game warden who recognizes George, he'll have to kill him. George was wanted for murder in Wyoming, Montana, but not in Idaho. But he was that kind of guy, like Shoya, Master Shoya. He was a real person. He was all there. And Stonehouse was that kind of person. All there.
Who did you meet any other real people in your first pilgrimage into the mountains? And who did you meet? What were the modern day hermits, like the modern day Cold Mountains and stone houses, like?
I didn't meet any poets, but that's beside the point, because poetry really doesn't have much to do with the practice. Well, the ones I met are in that book called Road to Heaven. It's never sold. Maybe every year it sells 200 copies, something like that. Every year in China it sells, Jesus Christ, a couple hundred thousand every year. It's already sold over 2 million copies in China. But it turns out the people I ran into in the mountains were these great Buddhist teachers. Most hermits, it turns out, I use the word hermit, and it's not really apropos, but I don't know what other word to use, because we use the word for misanthropes, people who want to be left alone and live outside of society. But the Chinese hermit has always been, for the last 5,000 years, an important part of society. In fact, it's hard to think of a more important member of society than the Chinese hermit, because they go into the mountains. They're like, it's like descendants of the old shamanic tradition. There are certain members of society who have certain powers, and the Chinese hermit tradition is like that. There are people who want to follow a spiritual path to the higher elevations, and they go to the mountains for a few years. It's It's sort of like what we call graduate school for the spiritually inclined. The average hermit spends around 3 to 5 years. But you get some 10-year people, some 20-year people. I met one hermit who'd spent 50 years. No, two hermits who'd spent 50 years. But anyway, the people I met were serious practitioners. And you meet all kinds. Of course, you meet newcomers who you have to wonder if they're really going to get past that first winter. Because when you go into the mountains, nobody helps you. That's sort of the code. And of course, there aren't many hermit mountains in China, maybe not even 1%. But there are hermit mountains where people have been going for, you know, thousands of years. That's the hermit mountain. When you go in there, there's a hermit network. But when you first go up there, you're going to have to get through that first winter on your own pretty much. But if you can get through that, then you're sort of part of the hermit team. And they look in on each other. Usually the new hermits don't know much Qigong, for example. They're very good at meditation, but they're not really good at certain exercises that are good for the health. And they don't know anything about botany and identifying wild plants and or what you can eat, what you can't eat. And maybe they're not too good at growing vegetables either, but all hermits are vegetarians in China. They're celibate, whether they're Buddhist or Taoist. Well, occasionally you meet some Taoist couples. You do Taoist, but that's not common. It's not frowned on or anything. It's just not common. Anyway, they live a simple life. They have to take care of themselves, and it's a hard life. And again, about 3 to 5 years they spend up in those mountains. The Zhongnan Mountains are the most famous because these hermit mountains are always located near some center of civilization, because they have this connection with civilization, with society. That's where the great teachers are. In fact, during the Tang Dynasty, they made a joke because if you wanted to get a job as an official, you had to pass exams. Well, if for some reason you couldn't pass these exams, in the Tang Dynasty, people started going up to the Zhongnan Mountains and building huts. It was called the Zhongnan Shortcut. Because they figured, well, if I build a hut, I'll be noticed. People will think I'm a practitioner, and they'll call me down to be an official. So that's the attitude people have toward these people. These are people who are above the red dust. Those are the kind of people you want working in the government, taking care of the people.
Bill, I've heard you quote this adage that there are two types of hermits. You've got big hermits and little hermits. And the little hermits are the ones who are out in the hills, in the mountains. And the big hermits are the ones who actually come back and live in the city. But then you've got your own follow-up to that, that actually to be a big hermit, you've got to be a small hermit first. You have to, you know, study in the hills. Could you say a bit more about that? What the course of study is? What is this PhD program that the hermits are getting when they go off to the hills?
Well, of course, it's a degree that's self-awarded. It's awarded by those you meet when you come down. It basically, what it comes down to is, you go into the mountains to discover something for yourself, but as far as the outside world is concerned, what it amounts to is somebody who can find their own voice. And you can tell somebody who speaks from their heart, or whether they're speaking the words of their teacher or something they learned in a book. And that's you might say, the object. That's the result. That's the benefit of this sort of periods of solitude. Is it gives you the opportunity to find your own voice, to find. You know, obviously, you've read sutras or you've studied with a teacher and all that sort of stuff, but those are just words. But when you start spending time alone, those words disappear, and suddenly you don't have any words left, and you're just sitting there, just trying to get through the day. And that's when your own voice comes. Or not. because not everybody is there's different degrees of success.
Bill, I know that you've talked about how for you translating, as Ajahn Kobilo said, is like a dance, and you can't hear the music, but you dance with this poet or this partner. And if you dance day after day after day, you begin to get a feel for the music through them. And I'm curious, after dancing to that, you know, Chinese music over your whole life, what have you learned about, you know, this is going to be a very broad stroke, but about the Chinese heart and voice that's been, you know, echoed through their history? And what have you, do you feel you've learned about kind of the American voice or heart from that contrast, or maybe that you wish we had learned from the Chinese wisdom as well? Just those two musics, what would you be able to say about them?
Well, the first definition we have about Chinese poetry, written around the year 200 or so by a man named Zheng Xuan. Poetry is words that come from the heart. It's what the heart is focused on that it then is put into words. That's what Zheng Xuan said. And so it's always has to do with the heart. The Chinese poetry is sentimental, but not maudlin. It's always about the pain of being a human being. And about the joy of impermanence, of being doomed to live only a few years, a little bit longer than some trees, not as long as other trees. Anyway, the poetry is a language of a cultural shared voice and aspiration of solace that one expresses toward one's fellow beings. I know nothing about American poetry, and I can't say anything about how it compares to what people write about in America. I don't write poetry. I couldn't write a poem if I tried. I mean, I probably could, but it wouldn't be worth, you know, publishing or anything. But what I've learned is it's like I tell people, it's like I would never get on a dance stage and dance in front of other people, but I sure would go on a dance stage and dance with somebody who was already dancing. If I was attracted to that dancer. And I meet these poets and read their poems, and I have to dance with them, you know, discover the rhythms, because it's all about, you know, the rhythms. It's not just the rhythms of the words, but it's the rhythm of their hearts. That's why, you know, every translator is going to do this differently. There's no perfect translation. The word perfection is inappropriate. Translation. It's not what translation's all about. Mm-hmm. A lot of people think translation is, using the dance metaphor, they think translation is putting my English feet on my Chinese dance partner's feet and then dancing like that. That's literal. That's accurate. Kills the dance, of course. You know, the one thing I did learn from this person who knocked on my door and introduced me to my first publisher, my first two publishers, Michael Connor, when I showed him some of my translations, he cringed. Because I didn't know what I was doing. He said, "Bill, if you're going to translate a poem, you have to make a poem. Otherwise you're dishonoring the poet you're translating. You have to make a poem. You just can't say, well, I put it's accurate or literal or something like that. You can't chicken out." I went down a lot of dead ends trying to figure out how to make a poem, not being a person who can make a poem myself. But looking at reading somebody else making a poem, I started to figure it out. And
Bill, I heard one talk that you gave, I think at Naropa University, but you said that not only did you figure it out, but that you feel like you had like come to a conclusion, like the secret of translating poetry. Would you be willing to share what that is, with the heart of translation?
I don't know. I forgot it.
Yeah.
Well, the secret is, of course, discovering that heart. But I mean, I don't know what words I might have used on that occasion. But it's all about being able to get past the words of a poem. You can't let the words of a poem limit you or create the boundaries of what you're going to do, because those words are Chinese words. And so poetry, translation of poetry is a performance art. It's something you that internalize this dance you do with this other poet in the rhythm of the words and the feelings that are going on. And it becomes addictive, because you I love that. I love to dance like that. I would again, dancing alone is meaningless. The very idea doesn't make sense to me. But dancing with somebody else who really knows how to dance with words and heart, that I love. And so I do it every day. It's legal.
Bill, we'll open things up to questions in a bit so people can add questions into the chat. But in addition to being an art, translation being a dance, you've also written that translation and you write a book to learn, and you've been translating since early 70s. What is this like, taking like your teacher to be all of these basically people who've died centuries, if not more than a millennia ago? How do you extract the essence, the essential teaching, and learn a lesson from pages?
Well, I don't know if I get the essence or not. I get something. I get enough to make a poem. And the thing about that is, I think I got it, and I move on. I go back and look at that poem I think I got, and suddenly I got to do this again. So translation of poetry is a never-ending process. But I love to dance, and it doesn't matter about not getting it right, because it's in poetry, in translation, there's no right. There's definitely wrong. There's absolutely wrong. And there's good and there's bad. There's different degrees of quality of translations, because you have to make a poem, you have to reach people. But basically, you have to reach yourself first. The poem has got to reach you as a translator, and then you've got to express that somehow. But and again, I'll go on the I'll read the same poem the next day, and I'll do it differently. I'll dance it differently, and this will go on and on and on until the publisher says stop, and that's when I stop. But I know I could always have done that differently, and that's but that's again, poetry translation is not about perfection. It's about a performance and about exemplifying that initial Chinese performance with an English performance. So I accompany the dancer. Don't try to become the dancer. And every other translators are going to accompany that dancer differently. Though there's no perfect or anything, but it's a very enjoyable pursuit. Keeps me off the streets. If I relied on it for income, of course I'd still be on food stamps. Thank God the Chinese have discovered my Buddhist stuff.
And actually, Bill, on that point, you have translated numerous sutras, and I'm curious, how is that experience different for you, translating a sutra, a Buddhist text, How is the music difference? Would you use a different would you use a different analogy for that? Tell us about that experience.
Absolutely. Yeah. It's not, there's no dance going on. No, it's not a dance. It's a meditation with Buddhist sutras. But it's, again, it's a process of getting past the words. The sutras themselves are performances, very high level performances, exquisite. And so when you first read them, you don't think that. It's only after you spend some time you see what's going on, getting to that point where you can see this, in a sense, like the structure of a sutra. I mean, Diamond Sutra is a good example. It's just a lot of sutras, like the Diamond. The sutra is over in the first three lines, and I'd say most good sutras, that's the sutra. The first three lines summarize the sutra, give the teaching, and the rest of the sutra is an expansion of that. So when you're translating a sutra, you've got to really look for things that people don't normally see. I don't know anybody who's ever said that before, but I know because I translate these texts that most sutras are over in the first few lines. That's the teaching. And you've got to be able to get that, and it takes a long time to do that. So you have to spend a lot of time. I use when I'm doing a sutra translation, I'm always using my daily meditation, like you would for meditating on a koan, where you meditate on words, but you don't think about them. And I never take anything that anybody has said about anything to determine how I'm going to translate a sutra. I have to put the sutra together as a work of art, I wish I had more skills, and I am really blessed that I've been able to acquire the skills I have. I would have much preferred to have learned some more Sanskrit than I've been able to acquire, which is not much, but I can use a Sanskrit dictionary. And I have people, like when I was working on the Lankavatara, there were two professors who came up to me one day at a sutra thing. It was Dan Lusthaus at Harvard and Paul Harrison at Stanford. Said, we've heard you working on the Lanka. If you have any problems, let us know. And they're probably the two of the greatest, you know, Sanskrit Buddhist scholars that I know of. Of course, Lusthaus is a Yogacara specialist. And Paul Harrison is the Diamond Sutra expert in the world. Mm-hmm. He works with all the... When people find shreds of early texts in Pakistan or Afghanistan, they send them to Paul to look at, to try to figure out. Anyway, so to translate a sutra, you've got to be blessed by the gods, because you're going to need a lot of help. You can't just look at the words of the page and start translating. And I've seen people do that. And there's a line, a sutra is like a series of bells, sort of, that all resonate with each other. And if you don't get your English words right, they're not going to ring. So that, because they ring in Sanskrit or sometimes not in Chinese. That's where I was having problems with translating the Diamond, when I was relying on the Chinese, and I wasn't getting it until I ran into this Taiwanese nun who had published a four-volume study of the grammar of the Diamond Sutra in Sanskrit, the Sanskrit grammar. And I heard the bells, and I could translate that. So translating sutra is different than translating a poem. And of course, a sutra can be very long. A poem is usually eight lines, maybe. So it's something you can do in a day, typically. But a sutra is going to take you, quite a long time, years. And it's going to take a lot more luck or good karma to translate a sutra than it would a poem. Because a sutra is different. People are going to read that thing and they're going to use it for their practice. So you just can't say, well, that's good enough. You can't stop with good enough. Again, it really has to reach you in a deep level that you really have to feel, I got this baby. And I can say that with the heart and the diamond and even the Lanka, took a long time. Like when I was just getting ready to turn in the final draft of the Lanka Vatara, this poet named William Merwin lived in Hawaii and asked me if I would come to Hawaii and explain the Lanka to him, because we had the same publisher. So anyway, William Merwin was a friend, and I said okay. So I went to Hawaii and I spent a couple of days trying to explain the Lanka to him, and I realized I was using the wrong words. And then I changed the words, and he got it. So it's just something like that. You never know when you're going to get that right word, because certain words, again, they're like bells. They resonate differently to us. You go into a thesaurus and there's like 10 words there, but maybe only one of them is going to work. Mm-hmm. Anyway. So that's sutra translation.
On this topic of just wording, this is a question from someone. So you refer to real people. This is something you said earlier today. And if I, and it resonates deeply, though I couldn't explain why, how does one become a real person? Can one learn? And this person has Road to Heaven on their shelf.
Well, I don't think I've ever used that phrase before, a real person, but I mean it, and it's appropriate. It means not a fake. The opposite of a fake person. And we all wear masks. I mean, that was one thing I learned as a young boy a lot, because I grew up in a family. My father was a very powerful, wealthy man. Rich people would come. It was one of the chief fundraisers for Kennedy in the western half of America. The Kennedys used to come to our house in Idaho. Anyway, I would meet all these kids, all these people, and I was a kid, and they were fakes. These powerful, rich people were frauds. So I mean, they were. It's like they were just pretending to be something, and so. By real people, I mean somebody who's not pretending anymore, who has no pretense. That's their whole being, is that's the way they are.
Thank you, Red Pine. And we have to wrap up soon, but I had hoped you could finish and leave us with a poem by Stonehouse that you could sing and recite. And maybe, I don't know if you have two ready, but at least one would be really, really lovely.
Okay, well, I think I have one. Chang Yen Xin Li Hun Wu Shi Mei Er An Zhong Le You Yu Fan Ba Nong Tian Cha Zhi Liao Zhi Bian Cuo Shi Shu You Yu. I mean, when I sing these, you notice that the words don't rhyme anymore. The Chinese language has changed a lot. So, yeah. All Chinese poetry rhymes, but these don't, because they were written so long ago. And modern Chinese is Mandarin pronunciation has only been around for about 400 years. And these poems are all written like, what, 900, 700 years ago. Not one care in mind all year. I find enough joy every day in my hut. And after a meal, a pot of hot tea, I sit on a rock by the pond and count fish. How could you not love a man like that?
Bill, thank you so much for This felt quite sacred in a lot of ways. And it just, we had someone in the chat just say,
Iwasher, she teaches at DRBU.
Okay. Yeah. Mr. Porter, I have learned from your translations for years. Thank you so much for your inspiration. So,
you're welcome.
We're very grateful to be so near. We're just down the road, basically, and hopefully our paths converge soon. But this has been a real pleasure of an interview. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you for inviting me.
And we'll move on to Zoom. For those who are interested, I'll paste the link into the chat. Those who, for whatever reason, can't find it, you can go to clearmountainmonastery.org, and you'll see it under the Wednesday evening listing. Yeah, Bill, you, after we wrap up, just stay on for a second and then we'll jump on. Okay. So we'll see everyone again soon. And Red Pine, thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you.
All right, Red Pine, will you be interested in jumping on over to Zoom? It's a good group.
Sure, yeah. Do I just click on one of those links?
Yeah, exactly. And we'll start the meeting right now.
Okay.
All right, we'll see.